Please be seated.
Good morning. Anything arising overnight? Nothing good. All right. Well, as you can see, we're joined today by two hearing managers from the Auckland Registry, Frieda and Charlotte. There's going to be a change in team from Monday as Cathy Harlow is leaving us to join the Ministry for the Environment to assist them on three pieces of legislation that evidently need drafting. So that's what Cathy's up to. And also our second member of the team, Laura, who is returning from her secondment back to the Disputes Tribunal. So they have been an outstanding team, and I am grateful to both of them for their participation in relation to this hearing and the tremendous amount of work. And you may not see it, but there is a huge amount of work that goes on behind the scenes to bring a hearing such as this to the court. It's nothing that the court has previously done before in terms of being a first instance hearing. So thank you to them both. Frieda and Charlotte now join us in Cromwell, and perhaps, and I'm not sure what's happening after Cromwell because there's also some Dunedin hearings, but we'll know that when we get to it. You'll also be hearing from Alex White, whom I think many of you know is my former hearing manager, now legal and research counsel with the Ministry for the Environment, but she returns to support this hearing over the weeks when we're not sitting in court, so that's when we're in chambers. So you'll be hearing from Alex for the next few weeks as well. So that's our team going forward. So we're up to the Department of Conservation, or Director General of Conservation.
General, ma'am. Yes, I'd now call Murray Brothers.
Affirm.
Do you solemnly sincerely and truly declare and affirm that in the matter now before the court will speak the whole truth, nothing but
I do.
Mr. Brass, is your full name Murray John Brass?
It is.
And you're a senior RMA planner for the Department of Conservation, Te Papa Atawhai?
I am.
And you have prepared three pieces of evidence for this hearing. The first one is dated the 5th of February 2021. The second one dated the 18th of March 2021. That's supplementary evidence. And then there's 23 March 2021 addition to your supplementary evidence. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And your qualifications and experience are set out in paragraphs 3 to 7 of your evidence of 5th of February 2021. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Do you have any corrections to your evidence?
I have one correction to make to the supplementary evidence dated 18 March. On the back page of that, in Appendix 1, and in there I've set out some proposed changes to wording for the bottom two policies.
I'm sorry, can you say that again?
Sorry, for the bottom two policies, 10A311 and 10A31A1, the added text, including priorities which, and that should say, are attached to the permit to be replaced. And I would note that I've corrected that in my consolidated against the full plan track changes version of 23 March.
Okay.
And with that correction, do you now confirm your evidence is true and correct?
I do.
Mr. Brass, you prepared an executive summary in your evidence of 5th of March. I know that we've moved on somewhat from that, but perhaps if you could move to that, that's on page 3 of your evidence, and talk us through.
Yep, if it would assist, I can talk through those and in each case sort of update with what is still relevant and where there may be changes to my position now. So the first point, the Director General of Conservation, Tumaki Ahure, Deputy General, DG, submitted in support of the intent of proposed Plan Change 7 that sought a number of changes to ensure it would achieve that intent, and that remains the case. My evidence supports the intent of PC 7 of providing for a transition to a fit-for-purpose planning framework for freshwater in Otago. That likewise remains the case. I have significant concerns about whether, as drafted, it would achieve that intent as a controlled activity pathway. Proposed Rule 10A31 is unlikely to be effective, and the alternative non-compliant pathway, Rule 10A3.2, is not sufficiently robust. And I would note that those concerns have been partially addressed through the redrafting and the 14 March version, but I do still have some concerns about the non-compliant pathway, which are outlined in my supplementary evidence, and reasonably significant concerns about the non-compliant pathway and the lack of policy direction for decisions under that pathway. So those concerns remain.
So moving to your para 4.
Yep, so point para 4. I also consider that PC 7 does not give effect to the National Policy Statement for Freshwater Management, and that submissions by the DG and others give scope for changes which would increase the extent to which the plan change gives effect to the NPSFM. That remains the case, but with, I guess, a change of flavour, that I understand that if we're looking for as simple a plan change as we can, there's going to be a tension between how many things we can achieve at that point and keeping it simple. My point 5 about the controlled activity pathway, that falls away based on the 14 March drafting. And my paragraph 6, first bullet point, implementing applicable Schedule 2A minimum flows on replacement consents where they have not yet been implemented in that catchment. That's something that I did recommend, as the minimum flows are already provided in the plan, and this would provide more protection for in-stream values than having no minimum flow. I retain that as an option. I think it is viable, and I think it would provide improvements, but I think it is up against that tension with trying to have as simple a controlled activity pathway as possible. So at this stage, I think it needs to be considered as we see that controlled activity pathway further refined, and from that, whether this is something that would fit with it or not. The second bullet point about banding or trigger flows for priorities, I have changed my view on that. I now agree that that would not be feasible to implement in the time remaining, and I consider that it could be addressed, however, by imposing conditions that carry over the priority status, and in my supplementary evidence I address some options for that. Also, not in my supplementary evidence, but in discussions of the last couple of days, has been around flow sharing agreements. I think in an ideal sense, I can see that they could take the place of priority arrangements, and certainly from what we've had presented to us so far, those arrangements would be better for the environment than the old priorities. However, that's not automatic, if you like, that all flow sharing agreements are going to be better for the environment. So again, there's that tension. If we bring them into the controlled activity pathway, that would require an assessment of them and therefore adding complexity. So I'm at this stage not resolved on whether that would be the right thing to do or how best to do it. And my last bullet point on that page, that falls away again in terms of the 14th of March drafting, but I do remain concerned, particularly with the non-compliant pathway, about the need to have policy to guide decisions on that. And I do make some recommendations in my supplementary evidence. I also note that supplementary evidence from other parties, including at least Ms McIntyre, Mr Farrell and Ms Dicey also recommends changes to address that same point in terms of having a clear objective, in particular to assess non-compliant activities against. I think that all of those have merits, but I think that's still in the melting pot as to what the right sort of distillation of those different ideas would be. And I remain open on that point. And that's my update on my key points.
You also, at paragraph 16 of your evidence in chief, set out a number of other key points and bullets there. And I wonder if you could take us through each of those, please.
Yep, so these are essentially a summary of, if you like, common ground from discussions with planners for Okaha, fish and game, forest and bird, Te Ao Marama, Ministry for the Environment and Wise Response. So just moving through the bullet points. The first one was that PC7 does not have adequate resource information, planning framework or understanding of Te Mana o Te Wai, so that any proposals here will by nature need to be short term and will need to be fully considered under the new land and water plan. Turning to top of page 7, most applicants will want to seek a longer term consent than offered under the controlled activity pathway. And that has been demonstrated by the information provided to us by Otago Regional Council staff. So if applicants are going to essentially change horses midstream, that's quite an ask. So that the controlled activity pathway does need to be simple and attractive, and if people remain in the non-compliant pathway, that needs to be robust. And that certainly remains the case. Policy wording should be as certain as possible. Could be a mix of qualitative and quantitative. That remains the case. Proposed wording that the activity have no more than minor effects, that has fallen away in the March 14 drafting. Clear policy direction is needed in policy 10A23 to provide certainty for applying section 104D. And further policy direction is also required to assist decision-making with respect to the controlled and non-compliant activities. That remains the case and remains a live issue in other planners' evidence as well. The middle bullet point there, the controlled activity pathway needs to be as simple and low cost as possible, consistent with the intent of the plan change, but does need to appropriately manage fresh water during the transitional six-year terms. This includes changes to the flow regime due to the priority system expiring without a replacement water management system being in place. And I should just make the point here that for all its faults, the operative regional plan water does address priorities, because when those consents are replaced, they go through a restricted discretionary activity process. They're required to provide hydrological and ecological information. That's assessed on its merits, and minimum flows or residual flows can be and are applied. So in that case, the loss of the priority system is being replaced with an RMA flow management framework, not a regional-wide one and not a Te Mana o Te Wai compliant one, but there is at least a replacement there to capture the risk due to the loss of the priorities. So that is a change which Plan Change 7, by creating a pathway that does not do that, and where consents would be rolled over just on their existing conditions, it's actually opening that door to that risk.
So you are halfway through that.
Yep. So this is primarily about avoiding unintended negative consequences to the in-stream values of water bodies, ecosystems and species, as opposed to providing advantages for irrigators and out-of-stream users. That's certainly not the Director General's interest in terms of the submission. It was around the ecological effects. Second last point there, consent decisions under the non-compliant pathway to allocate water for longer than the transitional 6 years need to be based on a sound understanding of the catchment hydrology, including low flow statistics, The policy framework should reflect that preferably this should include an understanding of the natural flow regime, and where this is not available, a higher degree of caution is warranted. And I think that's an issue that's still in play in terms of people's recommendations for drafting. And the final bullet point, reasonable in-scope opportunities to implement the MPSFM 2020 should be pursued in this plan change where that is consistent with submissions. And notwithstanding the tension with having as simple a pathway as possible, that obligation to implement the MPSFM as soon as reasonably practicable does remain a relevant consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Brass. If you could answer any questions that my friends or the court might have.
Questions from the court. So I see in your latest evidence dated the 23rd of March 2021 where you attach your recommended changes. Just to clarify, this is using a version of the plan change Mr. De Plaismaker has recommended as your base document?
Yeah, so this the base document is the 14 March changes with all of those changes accepted.
Yeah.
And then changes that I recommend further to that 14 March version are what are shown marked.
And I note that you have amended the or proposed an amendment to the objective. And my question is, did the Director General make a submission on the objective?
Yes.
And can you recall what that submission was?
It was essentially that wording. So in terms of work on structure and drafting, the submission stated, refine and simplify objective 10A11 to be the outcome sought only, and consequentially include any method content within policies 10A2.1 to 2.3. So that the concern that was raised there in the Director General's submission was that the objective as drafted is a mix of an objective and a method, which is the framework. So it was seeking to have that clearly separate out and laid out.
So one of the issues for the court, and I think the parties, has been, well, what is the objective? It's an objective come method, but, you know, putting aside the method for one moment, well, what is the objective? And I was really interested to hear your evidence just now that in relation to priorities, you said that, look, the priority system is and has been being replaced under new consents or replacement consents being issued by this council, and it's being replaced through a flow management framework that is endeavouring to capture risks and deal with risks through minimum flows, residual and succession flows. But is, have I understood you correctly in that respect?
Yes.
Okay. And in dealing with, or replacing rather, the priority system, am I right in thinking it's not like for like? It's not at all, it's not like for like. Would that be fair?
No, and as far as I can work out, there is no direct like for like in the RMA toolbox.
No.
Mm. So consents that have been, or deemed permits that have been replaced so far, those priorities have been replaced with sort of the normal toolbox of minimum flows, residual flows. In particular, I'm not, aware of a take cessation condition being used, so it's generally been doing the ecological work, understanding what species are there, what flows they need, and then having, particularly for the tributaries where non-drodromous galaxis are found, residual flows, in some cases also tying that into minimum flows.
So where we grasp hold of priorities again, and you are recommending that in your matters of control and I think matters of discretion for the relevant rules, what are you trying to grab hold of there? When you say including priorities which attach to the permit, what is it that you're trying to grab hold of, and what is the outcome of doing so?
The intents of what under that current priority system, the higher priority permit holder can require lower priority permit holders to essentially release water so that they've got enough for their take, and that in doing so, they're leaving more water in stream for the stretch in between those consents, between the take points. So what I'm looking to do is to enable that to be retained. I would be upfront that I don't think there's a perfect way of doing that, and the ideal solution would be to go to bespoke residual flows with a good understanding of the catchment. But if we're going down the clean, simple rollover short-term process, then my thinking is about how best can we limit the risk during that period. And it's very much, in my mind, about risk management.
Oh, I agree with you. It's about risk management. And it usually is about risk management as well. Your assumption seems, well, your starting point or your assumed starting point is that the... am I correct in thinking that if this comes in via a plan change and is imposed as a condition of consent, that the regional council could enforce the priority in some way to make the higher order or higher priority water permit release water downstream? Is that how you see it working?
Yes, there would have to be. It would have to be a compliance or enforcement element to it. Under the deemed permit regime, and I'm not aware of it ever having been tested, the wording was in a court of competent jurisdiction. Whether that is the Environment Court now, I'm not certain. Because I don't think that's been, I'm not aware of that having been tested. So if it was carried over through as a condition of consent, then yes, my understanding would be that the regional council would be the first port of call for enforcement if that was required. My understanding from my dealings with them is that they're generally resolved between the parties. So, you know, the higher priority person says, I can't get my water, I've got the higher priority. That seems to generally be accepted, and people operate that way. And as we've had discussed, increasingly people are moving to formal or informal catchment arrangements where those arrangements have been brought into the way the overall catchment operates.
To be fair, there are some real issues afoot in terms of, you know, presently are these deemed conditions on a deemed permit there for any valid RMA purpose or something else, and do they get exercised or enforced, if you like, through a court of general jurisdiction, a civil court, or can they be enforced either privately as between individuals in the Environment Court or by the council? And I really want to set that aside because I think that's an issue for the lawyers, but just looking at if it's in, assuming that it can come down into the plan change and assuming that it then attaches to a condition of consent somehow, what do you see the regional council doing in relation to these priorities? Is it, as I've just put to you, that the consent holder with a higher priority, the regional council can require water to be supplied to the consent holder with a higher priority, such that to ensure that that higher priority consent holder takes or has water to take? And is that how you see it?
Yes, and in that regard, I would see it operating essentially, as I understand, a take cessation condition would operate.
Okay. On a case by case.
Yep.
Responding to flows in the environment.
Yep.
And the key point with this is that that's to benefit abstractors, to ensure that they have waters going past their point of take, correct?
The trigger for implementing it is going to be the abstractor's need.
Yeah.
The ecological impact is retaining those flows and the reach in between the two take points. So it's...
So that's the blur, isn't
yes,
it?
That's
yes. That's the blur, because actually I don't know that that's what the priority system... In fact, I'm reasonably... I do not believe, or do not understand, rather, that the priority system was there to benefit the environment at all. It was there to benefit abstractors, correct?
I'm quite confident that it was entirely about first in, first served for
first
the water.
First in, first served. Yep. And so replicating that system in the plan change, down through consent conditions, does not necessarily result in an outcome which is beneficial for the environment. Rather, it's beneficial at least for abstractors, is it not?
I would hope it is both. So it is beneficial for the abstractor who has the higher priority,
yeah.
But by retaining that flow, and perhaps it would help I explain the key area of risk that's my concern, which is around the non-diadromous galaxa species.
Now, I'm not sure that I want to get into that. You can come back to that.
Yep.
But if that is your key area of concern, and you can elaborate on that, you can elaborate on that after I've asked my questions. If that's the key area of concern, then nothing in this objective secures their continued survival or secures their... manages the risk that they will not become critically endangered or extinct. Nothing in the there's no outcome to that effect, is there?
Through Plan Change 7, no, I agree with that, and that was one of the drivers for, as I understand it, the concerns raised in the Director General's submission.
Yeah. So if that's what you want to achieve through the Regional Council enforcing priorities by way of cessation condition to manage the risk to those critically endangered or threatened populations, do you not have to say that in the objective?
The objective for Plan Change 7, yes, I think that would be preferable.
Mm.
And I'm aware that there are, I think Ms. Dicey's evidence recommends, her supplementary evidence recommends an additional policy to that effect, and there are other versions of wording around along those lines. I haven't recommended that myself, but I do support some of those other suggestions.
Because if the purpose of a priority currently is not to benefit the environment, though that might be, that may
a
result,
side effect.
It may not, but it's certainly not its purpose, then why bring them in unless you are, why bring them in the absence of an objective which is driving that outcome?
Yeah, I would agree that it would be preferable to have an objective policy leading to the rule, yes.
Now, you've got some of these priorities at least have been replaced by replacement consent conditions, which you note seek to manage flows in an abstractor risk in a different way, correct? And you're nodding, so yes for the record.
Yes.
I thought this plan change at its simplest was trying to roll over, that's an imperfect term, roll over deemed permits and replacement permits in a way which reflects the drivers in the environment now. And by that I mean those mechanisms or means wherein the environment has changed as a consequence of the taken use of water, whatever that is, it continues for the next 6 years. So the outcome is one of mimicking the drivers of change within the environment. That's what this plan change is trying to do. It's not trying to improve the environment or bring about other changes in the environment. It is meant to be replicating the environment in some way. Is that at its highest level, that is what it's doing?
That would be my understanding. I'd perhaps characterise it as a holding pattern.
Mm.
So if the current state of play can be held for 6 years, and then the new plan comes into play. So, yes.
So if that is the pattern, if you can put it like that, that's the pattern in the environment, then what are abstractors doing to create that pattern has to be an important question to the court or for the court. Correct?
Yes.
And you're nodding. Yeah.
Yes.
And priorities, the exercise of priorities may or may not be one of those tools that consent holders are using to create that pattern in the environment.
Yeah, I'd be, from what I know, I'm quite certain that it is part of the environment, but exactly how much and exactly where is information that I don't have to hand.
And have you read it in anybody's evidence?
No, and this is something that was raised in the DG's submission, further submission in a meeting with regional council staff I was involved with at the start of last year. The issue for the Department of Conservation is that it doesn't hold the information on deemed permits. That's held by the regional council. The regional council is responsible for managing water. It's also the promoter of this plan change, which, as I note, does shift the position from the current plan change with the restricted discretionary activity dealing with the priorities. So that's a change that is being initiated and driven by the regional council. They hold the information. It had been the hope that we would have more light shed by now. I should point out that I do think it's not impossible that more light could be shed before the end of the hearing.
So in terms of our current environment or the patterning within our current environment of flows with giving rise to effects within the environment, priorities may or may not be influencing that patterning within the environment. And I think the answer to that must be we don't know because we haven't seen the information. They may not, but to the extent to which they are, we don't know. Is that fair?
I think that's fair. I think the mechanism by which it can have those effects is clear, but the extent to which that mechanism is applying and where it's applying is unclear.
Okay. And we've also heard that in many catchments there are flow share agreements. Again, these are not in evidence, so the court hasn't seen any examples of this, but those agreements, where they exist, may also be changing the patterning within the environment, correct?
Yes.
And again, the significance to that, or the extent to which that is so, we don't know.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. And we heard yesterday there was policy in the water plan to do with dealing with water at times of water restrictions. I've forgotten what it's called now. But it's the page. Can you help me out there? That was your
I think we
genius.
Were talking about policy 6413.
6413, and that's about water restrictions.
Well, it was
Is
a companion policy to the flow sharing, the water sharing agreement policy suite from 6412A and onwards.
But did they use the phrase water restrictions as opposed to water sharing in that policy? Or did some other
Well,
language?
6413 did, because 6413 was about how to apply water restrictions when there are flow sharing arrangements in place.
Oh, okay, then that's all I need to know.
Yes.
Yep, thank you. So with that in mind, there's also policy in this water plan which is encouraging catchments or groups of users, at least, to some other arrangement which may of itself then influence the patterning in the environment.
Yes.
Okay. And, you know, the council has a number of tools in its toolbox which we've talked about, minimum flows, recessions, residual flows, minimum flows and secession conditions, which they of themselves also influence the patterning in the environment.
Yes.
Yep. So, where you change the hydrological flow at a surface water body, or change levels in a hydraulically connected groundwater body, that change may induce an effect in the environment, in-stream or outstream environment.
Correct, yep.
And that that change may lead to an effect which is adverse
yes.
or beneficial. Yep.
Yes.
And where we're dealing with water, we're not just dealing with, you know, the abstraction of water at certain points and the input of water at other points, you know, through principally through the primary sector, but actually also through water taken to generate electricity. But we are dealing with a whole multitude of inputs into that environment that are coming from or associated with land use too.
Yes, yes.
And that those, the aggregate or the cumulative effect of those inputs are an effect on a host of different elements of the environment which vary in space and time.
Yes, it's complicated.
It's complicated.
Yes.
So in trying to understand what this plan change is trying to do within the time that it has, 6 years, if this plan change is able to allow permits to be replaced for a short period of time in a way which mimics the environment, and I don't use that indicating any level of precision, because how would you know where you have cumulative effects varying in space and time, which the inputs of which are not necessarily anthropocentric, but are also global.
Yep. So you're talking in a broad sense rather than a fine-grained...
Broad sense. Yep. If it is to mimic the environment as we have it now, with the adverse effects such as they are, is that an outcome that the Director General would be, or you would be rather, satisfied with?
I think the term that I would use is grudgingly.
Grudgingly.
And partly, always looking for environmental improvements is the direction that we should be heading. The MPSFM gives us some pretty clear directions in that regard. So I think to have a situation where we lock in or hold the current environment, the current patterns, interactions for 6 years, we need to be confident that that is going to deliver enhanced benefits in the longer term. And that, to me, is perhaps the nub of this plan change, is holding things for 6 years to allow a clearer, more orderly transition to a land and water plan framework, which one would hope will be better for the environmental outcomes. Does being able to move faster to that new framework provide more benefit than the costs or the benefits foregone over the first 6 years?
So there's a risk to Galaxits in particular now in mimicking that environment where those risks, which have led to that risk, which is extinction of certain species and certainly increased likelihood of extinction to other species. But if the environment is mimicked through the plan policies but not improved, that is an outcome this plan change could and should be striving for.
Could you repeat the outcome that you see from there?
The problem with Galaxids. I mean, I understand some of them are critically endangered and some of them are threatened, correct?
Yes.
And so, especially for those that are critically endangered, there is an extinction risk now.
Yes.
With that in mind, there is an extinction risk now with the current patterning within the environment, which is not just simply the use of water, but it's the inputs into the system of the environment, both man-made and natural. Is it an outcome that seeks to not worsen that risk as best as it can, as best that not worsen the risk to take critically endangered to extinction? Is that actually a realistic outcome?
I think it is, and I'm not the freshwater expert, so that's based on my understanding of Dr. Dunn for the department, but also a number of other freshwater experts. I think the two key risks are simply by holding the existing pattern for a number of those species, they're in decline under the current pattern.
Yeah.
So by delaying improvements for 6 years, there's that risk of continued decline continues for that 6 years. The other concern that I have is around the loss of priorities, and if that changes the flow regime in one of the locations of one of those fragmented populations of a threatened Galaxis, that it either loses habitat or potentially loses that population entirely. So that's a risk where if the priority system is not kept as part of that pattern in some way for the further 6 years, then that is a change to the pattern, and that's what creates the risk.
That your assumption is that the environment is an expression of a priority pattern, and that assumption may not be correct.
That assumption may not be correct. As I've said, the mechanism that creates that risk, I think that is clear. That's not an assumption, that's just the way that mechanism works. Whether that assumption is true or not, I'd perhaps almost reverse the assumption, which is that the proposed changes by having a straight rollover pathway which doesn't bring forward priorities, that creates a risk, and the thing that needs to be disproved, if you like, is that risk. So if the regional council or other parties were able to bring evidence that showed that the priorities are not being exercised now in a way that creates risk to Galaxis populations, then we could put that risk aside. But my concern is that if we assume that that risk is not playing out and we go ahead with Plan Change 7 as currently drafted, that risk remains. So we need to, in my view, put that risk to bed as part of the decisions on Plan Change 7.
Mm. Well, this case is all about risk management in an open system, if I could put it that way, an open and dynamic system. Is that not what
it is? Yes, that's a fair description.
Yeah. And we've already heard evidence from Mr. Hickey that the change in environment is also a product of efficiency improvements.
Yes.
Those efficiency improvements, while driven by the water plan, were not necessarily known or predicted to have occurred when the Regional Council granted consents, which were driving those efficiency gains.
I would challenge that.
You challenge that?
Just in that I worked in the Regional Council, yep, in the late 90s, and probably with the ones I was involved with, it was more around flood, wild flood or border dike irrigation, and the fact that you lost when you made that more efficient, by at that stage people were often changing to K-line, that you lost the water that passed through, that was well known.
I don't think
it was an unknown risk.
Not an unknown risk, and I know that Commissioner Edmonds and I have both encountered this extensively in other parts of the country as well, so it's a known risk.
Yep.
Nevertheless, Council took it and drove improvements in the efficiency gains in the irrigation infrastructure, and that of itself has resulted in change, which is change to an induced base flow to the surface water and groundwater.
Yes, definitely.
Which then has consequential effects in the environment. So that's also something which is at play.
And it does, and I think this is your point, is that if we want to hold the pattern, it's actually a very dynamic, changing pattern to hold.
Okay.
And I fully acknowledge that, and that is why, in terms of my recommendations, suggestions for retaining a version of the priority system, I don't see that as in any way an ideal or an end state. It's a risk management tool to get us through the 6 years, hopefully without losing populations of those galaxies, and then transitioning to a framework which is much more effective.
Priorities are just one lever of many levers which may be inducing change in this environment, correct?
Yes.
Manage priorities, but not managing other levers might itself bring about change in the environment which you haven't turned your mind to yet.
Yes, but I think the distinction is that the change to priorities is a direct result of Plan Change 7 changing the planning framework.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things which are happening in terms of farming technology, practices, water uses that aren't directly controlled by the plan change, or Plan Change 7 is not going to make any difference to. The priorities is something that Plan Change 7, by changing the way those consents are replaced, has a direct impact, a direct bearing on the way that priorities play out.
It may do.
Yes.
May do. Because you can't affirmatively say that it will do when you don't know whether and to what extent they're being exercised now. Correct?
It will definitely extinguish the priorities. So that is known. They will disappear and not be replaced. What is not known is what the impact of that is in any particular case.
But also what is not known is if you then bring this forward as a mechanism in a valid mechanism in a plan change and therefore capable of being enforced by the regional council on a consent by consent basis, you can't predict to what end or whether in fact the council will even do that.
I guess that's a position that we have with the entire plan change.
Mm. All right. Any questions, Commissioner?
Good
morning.
Well, you'll be maybe pleased to know that some of the territory has been covered already. I do want to pick up this issue of priorities, though, to understand at a practical level just how it might work in terms of a condition on a permit. So you mentioned it would be the regional council's responsibility to enforce the priority regime if they come down through into conditions. So let's stay, for example, with the situation where the holder of the highest priority is further down the catchment, and thus water might need to be left in the river to ensure that there is water available for that priority to be exercised. My understanding is that the water only needs to be left if that priority is going to be exercised, and I think you picked up on that in terms of noting it was demand driven.
Yes. Yep.
In that context, so when you think about a take cessation condition being put on the upstream permit in a way that somehow the regional council can enforce, that would require some knowledge as to what the downstream higher priority user requires by way of water demand?
Yes, it would, and the regional council holds that consent information as well.
But the council wouldn't hold the information as to when the priority was going to be exercised?
No, and my understanding of how they currently operate is, as I say, I'm not aware of a case where it has gone to court, so it's been managed between the permit holders. I would expect that would remain the first port of call, with the regional council enforcement mechanisms as the backstop. Essentially, if your higher priority consent holder is talking to the lower priority one, that's the stick that they've got.
Right, so you see the condition in that context as a regulatory backstop in case the phone call from highest priority to lowest or lower priority isn't effective.
Yes, and also in the situation where, as we've heard over the last few days, in quite a few cases, users within those catchments have established their own operating regimes, which this would be part of. So that would, I would expect, to be part of the enforcement or implementation mechanism. But I do also note that, from my experience, not all users within a catchment have always chosen to join those systems, so there is a need for an enforcement backstop.
In your experience with flow sharing regimes, are environmental considerations the driver?
I wouldn't claim to have a lot of direct experience with flow sharing regimes. In that regard, I probably defer to the evidence that's been put by the likes of Mr. Hickey.
So if you think about the utility of a flow sharing regime and some of the benefits that we heard from Mr. Hickey, it would, if those were to track into PC7 in some shape or form, it would be important to capture the environmental aspect to ensure that the flow sharing regimes weren't simply about the sharing of water for abstractive use as their sole purpose.
Absolutely, and that's one of the potential wrinkles is, as I understand or as they've been described, they're a mechanism for sharing the water and managing in a way which manages to either a current or an expected minimum flow. If that minimum flow is not there, which could be the case for the next 6 years, it's not clear what they would be managing to or what the driver would be. And if it was simply a way of apportioning the water between users with nothing left for the environment, then there would be no environmental benefit.
Want to head back up the planning food chain to the objective, and I want to explore with you the suggestion in terms of a change to the objective that you've recommended. But before I get to that, I just want to pick up on a point you made in your summary, where you'd observed at your paragraph 3 that the non-complying pathway was not sufficiently robust. Do you agree that the pathway, which is the policy and the rule that has now been put forward by Mr. De Pelsmaker, is sufficiently robust?
It's potentially too robust. If both doors of the 104D are as close to closed as they can be, then it's very hard to see. I certainly struggle to see how an application could get through. But I think there is also a lack of robustness there because it's not clear if an application did get through, what would be the criteria, the standards, what would it be measured against to enable it to get through, because we don't have a clear objective to measure it against.
And that's then the genesis for the recommendation that you make to change the objective to better capture the outcome being sought?
Yes, and I think it's probably an iterative process. I don't think I've nailed the what would be a final version of that wording, but the intention there is that this plan change is about enabling a transition so that when we get to the land and water plan, that can have a speedy and effective transition to the new regime. And I think that does give us a yardstick to measure non-compliant activities against, in the sense that would this activity undermine that, or would this activity not undermine that ability?
So, in a sense, the door needs to be left open for activities that don't undermine that outcome. That's what you have in mind?
Yep, that's what my wording is, I think, partway towards capturing.
So, in your supplementary evidence, you step through a couple of examples where there might be a project with environmental benefits that might require consents, and you're trying to ensure that there is a pathway for those activities?
Yes, and as a, I think, a non-fanciful example, from things that I've been involved with would be, say, a wetland restoration where water requires to be diverted on an ongoing basis for that wetland, but usually those projects are looking to external funders, community funders, and they want to know that there's a security, a secure future for the restoration.
So let's stick with the wetland example for now. Let's say the funding was dependent on there being a 10-year permit required for that. How would that application then work its way through the non-complying framework?
My particular concern is around the policy. A case like that may well be able to make the effects no more than minor, but even if it passes that gateway, there's then got to be a substantive decision under 104, and that decision is against the policies and objectives. So in that case, you would be able to look and say, once we've got a new planning framework in place, is this the sort of thing that we would envisage being supported and being able to continue as currently proposed under that planning framework? If that's the case, then that would weigh towards grant of a longer term. If not, and the simple fact that it's restoration is not a get-out-of-jail-free card, if in diverting that water it was dewatering some important values downstream, it may be that it would not fit with that transition, but you would have something there to measure it against.
So in a sense, the tension created by having a directive policy saying avoid granting permits for more than 6 years, that tension can be somewhat addressed or resolved by the objective more clearly articulating the outcome that it's seeking to achieve.
Yeah, so then if we understand what the reason for that six-year limit is, then you've got something to test against.
And just to make sure we're on the same page, that the understanding there is about not undermining the future planning framework, the future NPS-compliant planning framework.
Yeah, that would be my understanding. There are also potentially arguments about activities where other policy statements such as REG and urban development come into play. I've struggled a little bit more about how you create a yardstick to measure those against, so I'm not in a position of putting wording forward, but I do accept that there may be a case. But again, I think you would be saying, if in 6 years' time we've got an NPSFM compliant framework, would the requirements of REG or urban development still justify this application or this consent being in place for a longer term?
So in a sense, your change to the objective may also assist or provide a platform for that argument to be had without providing a specific carve-out for those activities.
Yes, and I don't see that you need to have a, if you like, a named activity in the carve-out, but particularly in terms of the arguments made around the REG and also urban development, the framework needs to operate in a way where they can at least be tested against that.
Thank you. No further questions.
Thank you. Mr. Winchester.
I don't have any questions for this witness.
You don't? Okay. Ms. Baker Galloway.
Thank you, ma'am.
Mm-hmm.
morning.
Good morning.
Let's just go back to the objective again, just so I can be clear on where you're landing. In your the Director General's further submission and in your evidence in chief, there was originally support for the changes sought by Fish and Game in its submission, and you record that at paragraph 51 of your evidence in chief. And then, as you'll be aware, Fish and Game's drafting of that has evolved to now include a reference to not just phasing out over allocation, but also the environmental, preventing environmental degradation associated with further over allocation. Now, in your supplementary position, there's no reference to those parts of the themes that were originally supported by the DG, so I just wanted to just test if that's a conscious change in position or not.
It was recognising that for those other parties, and the Director General's submission also supported some wording suggested by Ngā Rūnanga, but recognising that those are in a state of change and people are coming up with new versions. So I guess I wasn't looking to slot in specific wording and say that this wording directly replaces what was sought in the submission or my original evidence. But I do think there is merit to those other approaches that are being proposed. I think there is likely to be further work on the wording, but I do support the intent of those that wording.
So as a matter of principle, just so we're all clear, you do support a statement at the objective level that references the environmental objective of Plan Change 7?
Yes, and that is with the tension, again, of providing as simple a pathway as proposed, but as the discussions we've had earlier, I have significant concerns about risk to Galaxa species in particular, because they don't have the ability to bounce back after 6 years. And so it would make sense to have, through the policy and objective framework, something that then that leads to those provisions.
And is that's why the wording that Ms. Dicey's put up in her supplementary that has a specific reference to threatened species as part of that environmental statement has more favour with you as far as drafting goes?
I wouldn't say more favour, but I certainly see the merit in that, as I do with some of the other suggestions.
Yeah, okay, thank you. And just on the topic of exceptions, just picking up on an answer you gave just before about, you gave an example about, say, wetland restoration and wanting to make sure that an exception for that sort of project that would need particular consents was not precluded. And I'm not trying to catch you out or anything, but just you've got familiarity with the National Environmental Standard for Freshwater, the regulations?
Yes.
And there are permitted rules for vegetation clearance and water permits within 100 metres of a wetland for the purpose of wetland restoration? Have you got a working familiarity with those?
A general familiarity. Wouldn't claim to be an expert on how they play out.
But given that there are those permitted rules in the regulation, for your example of wetland restoration, does that take away some of your concerns that an exception needs to be provided for that?
I would have that was put forward as an example. I'd have concern about picking apart a specific example and saying that makes the issue go away. I think there is a wider issue of needing to provide for, and certainly my experience has been, that with the best will in the world in plan changes, you try to cover all the eventualities, and 2 days after it becomes operative, something comes in your door where you go, oh,
Didn't think of that.
Didn't think of that.
Yeah. And what in terms of the work that the Director General, that the Department of Conservation is doing on restoration and enhancement in the, you know, the catchments that are going to be really the subject of PC7, have you or are you aware of any concerns with getting necessary consents for those types of projects to date?
Certainly the NES has raised significant concerns both within the department and within voluntary and environmental groups doing those sorts of works. But that is something that is still playing out, and I'm not sure what the outcome of that is going to be.
In Otago?
In Otago, yes. Yep.
But in terms of the work that the department itself does, like that, well, I'll put it to you this way. The department has an active program of works for restoration and enhancement.
Yes, yep.
And has the department had any issues in terms of getting those works authorised where they require a consent?
I think I'd characterise that as being currently in play. So there are issues with the NES and requirements, particularly around vegetation clearance and the fact that the vegetation clearance captures all vegetation, not just indigenous. So weed removal, particularly where it's involving sprays, mechanical activities, earthworks, is being captured by that. But that is something that is, it's a live issue right now, and I don't know where it's going to land.
And have you got any experience where there would be, where the department's restoration or enhancement projects require water permits to divert or take, specifically, so Plan Change 7 type water permits? Have you had any, aware of any issues in that regard?
Not aware of any issues, although I should point out that the way the planning, RMA planning function operates within the department, I'm part of an advocacy-based unit, and we do this. When the department itself needs consents for its own activities, that's dealt with by the people in that operations team, that local office. So we're not managing those consent applications or involved in that process for them.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand is the basis for your concern that a positive proposal that needs a consent, that's going to come up against real issues.
Yep. Yep.
And so from what you've said, I haven't actually heard anything where you've got a reason for that concern other than a hypothetical.
Well, we haven't had the situation of a six-year limit on terms in Otago in the past, and so that raises my concern. I'm sure there are other examples, and I'm sure there will be examples that I don't think of. So my concern is not so much to nail down the answer for a specific example, but I do believe that that is a valid concern, and it is something, therefore, that the plan change should seek to address and have a pathway where those situations, a case is able to be made. And I'm not by any means saying that, therefore, those things all automatically get 35-year consents. That's not the case at all. But they should have the ability to make the case and have some kind of a yardstick on which to base what their consent duration should be.
Yeah. One of your sort of preconditions, if you like, for exceptions is a reference to an activity having negligible effects. That's in your supplementary at paragraph 34. And when you make that statement, I just want to be clear in reference to what starting point, what baseline would you be measuring those negligible effects from?
I think if it's negligible effects, you'd have to be comparing it against, you know, pretty much a natural no-takes environment as opposed to a modified environment. If it's a modified environment that those effects are part of, that's a more nuanced assessment than simply saying the effects are negligible.
And also, if you're comparing it against the modified environment, that doesn't address cumulative effects, does it?
Yeah, so that would all need to be part of that assessment.
Yeah, OK.
Just to be clear, though, I'm not saying that negligible effects should be a precondition in all cases. Some things may have minor or less than minor effects, but still be able to make a case through that pathway.
OK. Again, in terms of exceptions, it's not apparent that your evidence supports exceptions for drinking water or renewable energy generation. Is that correct?
I think the phrasing I've used is that I'm open to, and I don't know that I specified those cases, and again, I'm looking not so much to be able to create bespoke pathways for specific activities. I think in a plan change like this, that's going to be difficult to do. It would very quickly get rather crowded and would after a simple plan change. So it's more a case of if there is going to be a non-complying pathway, and it seems to be without too much challenge that there will be some form of a non-compliant pathway, then my key concern is what's the test for applications going through that pathway to be assessed against.
Okay.
Oh, sorry, I should also note that there is, of course, also a restricted discretionary pathway. I haven't particularly discussed that in my evidence. I really see it as analogous to the controlled activity for cases where people don't have full data. But again, that then takes you out of an absolutely automatic rollover, as I think we're trying to get to with the controlled activity, to a restricted discretionary activity where there needs to be an assessment. And if there needs to be an assessment, you need to have a policy basis to inform that assessment.
Yep, yep. You'll be familiar with the partially operative regional policy statement.
Familiar. I wouldn't claim expertise on certainly it has been simplified now with pretty much just the one version.
Yeah. Do you agree that the partially operative regional policy statement gives effect to the national policy statement for renewable energy generation?
I wouldn't want to make a call on that without going back and refreshing my memory on the provisions.
Well, concluded to yourself that the Plan Change 7 is sufficient to give effect to the partially operative regional policy statement as it relates to renewable energy generation?
I don't think I would say that, and that's where I'm informed by a general view that I don't think Plan Change 7 is giving effect to much at all. It's holding that pattern for a time when we can give effect to NPSFM in particular, but other things such as REG you would expect to also be brought in at that point.
So I do need to put this to you because I put it to the other planners and I want to understand your position also. So if you can be provided with the partially operative RPS, please. And it's at CB 562.
Sorry.
First provision. Sorry, sorry, Kathy. So, Common Bundle page CB 562.
Yes, I have that in front of me.
So that's objective 4.3 and its associated policies, which I hope you've read recently because they've been the subject of a bit of attention. Can you have a quick read?
I have read those recently, but thanks for the opportunity to refresh.
Thank you. So first, the policies under objective 4.3, do you agree that by providing for the six-year rollover of existing takes, the renewable energy generation and municipal water supplies are provided for in Plan Change 7?
No, I would not agree with that. And my reasoning there is that that's essentially treating those activities exactly the same as all other activities, which are not have no national direction, are not recognised as having national or regional significance. So I'd expect that if there are activities with national or regional significance, that you would be able to distinguish how they are being provided for in the plan. And I don't think that needs to be through named or labelled provisions directly relating to them. And in my view, if the non-compliant pathway had some reasonable yardsticks to measure applications against, then in that case I think you could say that that provides a pathway where if they need longer term consents they're able to do that. I think that would be more providing for those activities than having the current both doors seem to be pretty much closed under the non-compliant. But I, with that, as I say, I don't see that that necessarily requires specific carve-outs or changes of activity statuses for either REG or drinking water.
So it doesn't require specific carve-outs. The area that you see needs more work is in the non-complying policy direction.
Yeah, so if there is a, if those activities, and I can foresee circumstances where they would be seeking longer-term consents. If the plan provides a reasonable gateway for those applications, then I'll consider that that is reasonably providing for them.
Okay.
All right. We're going to take the morning adjournment. But just so I'm checking in with and clear in my understanding, no carve-outs for municipal water supply or hydro, but rather outcomes more clearly articulated, I think you said, in policies, and I was going to put to you the objective.
Yes, yeah. Yes, policies and objectives.
And the objective. And the further amendment that you've made to the objective, enable a transition in the long term, you think sufficient for that outcome for hydro?
I don't think it's what I would say is final wording, but it's moving in that direction of being able to assess applications. Does this undermine the ability to transition to that new framework? Is this something that we could envisage continuing on longer term under that new framework?
All right, that's something to think about. I'm going to take a couple, time for a tea break.
All rise.